Hello and welcome. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, with David Cooper. I'm David Cooper. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, the show where no one's listening. No one cares. The show where every episode's the last episode. Tech, 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 technology. Today we have tech expert Carmi Levy to go over, well, I hope we get through at least one story. This one involves the fast food joint Wendy's, specifically one in Times Square here in New York. So let's get technology expert Carmi in front of a microphone. Is it possible you get more handsome every time I see you?
I'll say the same thing about you. Look at the hair, man. It's happening. I love it.
What, my hair or your hair?
Yeah, your hair. It's awesome.
I hide myself in Zoom so I can't see. Because I end up staring at myself. Have you heard of this Zoom dysmorphia? At the beginning of the pandemic, like plastic surgery went up and Botox and all these things went up.
Yeah.
Because people were in Zoom meetings just staring at their own. It's like if you have a mirror of yourself looking back at you and you have even a hint of narcissism or insecurity, you're just going to stare at yourself.
Oh, I can't look at myself. I can't hear myself. I hate the visual and the sound of myself completely. I only keep the video on when I do a Zoom call because I just want to make sure that my head is still on camera because I move around a lot. And if I'm not, aligned, down the barrel of the camera, I'll go off frame. That's the only reason I care about it. But I try not to look at myself because I just can't. It's like even mirrors. I hate mirrors. And I will deliberately walk a path to avoid intersecting a mirror because I just can't stand seeing myself.
Look at you, mister. I'm Carmi Levy. I show up on TV. I'm just doing hits on TV. Hello, technology expert Carmi's here because the iPhone 45 has a gigabyte of poop in it.
Yeah, it gets me recognized. We were in Montreal for a funeral last week, and I'm walking out of a restaurant for breakfast and some guy. So like, here I am, like what, 700 kilometers away from home. And some guy, like, he's like looking at me and he just goes, and he does like this, goes, "Hey, I know you. You're the tech guy." He goes, "I'm a tech guy, but not like you." And he like claps me on the shoulder, fist bumps me, and says, "Great to meet you." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, man. I'm glad you liked me. That, because it could have gone the other way."
Wow. I've never been recognized. I've been recognized for doing stand-up, and that's just like a local show. I did a stand-up show in San Francisco. There's maybe like 50 people in the audience. And the next day on the street, somebody stopped me. They were in the audience. So that was pretty cool.
That's so cool. See, I know your voice anywhere, right? Like from radio. And I recognize people's voices from, I've picked up on people like just in public. It's like, I know you, like you're a radio host. Like that's, and you've done, huge radio. So you probably have a lot of people out there who know you by voice.
Where? Huge radio? On what planet are you living?
You did the national show for how long, man? You're a brand, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, to all four people who are listening. I guess you were one of them, so there's three others out there.
I'm one of them, and I'm a very happy listener, so.
Thank you. Bernice, I assume, is her name. We were looking at my demographics when I used to have that job over a year ago. Wow. And it's like baby boomer ladies from like, I think 55 to like 75. That was my best demographic. That was my demographic. So, hey.
They're very loyal. They're lovely people. I visited a long-term care home to pick someone up, to bring them back to a Shiva house, which I knew you would appreciate. And as a woman I never recognized, she's like, "Can you pick up my aunt and bring her back to the Shiva house?" I'm like, "Sure, why not?" So I go, and I'm wandering the halls, and all I could think of as I'm wandering and all these people are like walking up to me, and it's like there's an up, like I bumped into people who knew me and knew my parents. It was the weirdest thing. And all I could think of is like,
Jews.
These are all listeners. Yeah. These are all like potential. These are the people who listen to CJD. These are the people who probably know who I am. I almost felt like I was home. It was weird. It's kind of a neat place.
There was this older baby boomer who would call my show named Mary, and she would only call when we were doing serious stuff. And she was like, David, I listen to you every night. I'm a big fan. And then she'd every wacky and disgusting or sex or poop related thing of the night, she would say, I don't like it when you do this. I'm like, why do you even listen? But she was there with us every night. But she had took serious issue with any inappropriate things I did.
Oh, that's darling, isn't it?
It certainly is.
I think she had an under, like, kind of like an undercurrent of, like, I think she was a bad girl back in the day. And ooh. I think she was just reflecting that in her, you know, protests to you.
During the Great War, she was a bad girl.
That's right. Had her own street corner and red light and everything. Oh, sorry, that was bad.
Carmi, you're canceled.
Won't take much. Sometimes I wonder, is like someone going to go back in my social media profile and like find something I posted that was like particularly nasty? I'm somewhat inclined to like maybe go and do a scrub, but then I'm like, you know what? If it's going to happen, BFD, I don't care. Let it.
Big fucking deal. This is a podcast, you can swear. I am sometimes worried about being canceled because I've done inappropriate things in the past. The guy I work with a lot who co-hosts a lot of stuff with me, Tony, has done inappropriate things in the past. But then the sobering reality of it is people have to care to want to cancel you, Carmi. Isn't that sad?
Yeah, but it means we get to do what we do. So, you know, I'm okay with that. It means we're not going to get stopped. Woohoo! All right.
I've never been stopped. I was once, and I just did a segment about how humble bragging makes you look bad. But regardless, I was in the New York subway with a well-known Canadian. Mm-hmm. And we were talking, and I like bumped into this lady who was standing close to me on the subway, and she was kind of with her family, and she kind of looked out of place. And I said, I'm so sorry. Like, I don't, and I introduced myself. I'm like, I'm David. I don't know why I introduced myself. And the woman says, I'm Canadian. I know who you guys are. And then I screamed. I said, you know who I am? And she's like, well, no, I know who he is.
Close enough. You're known by association. That's okay. You'll take it in whatever form.
I did get stopped once for doing voice work for a radio station at Burning Man. I voiced a character named Butthole Steve, who did a lot of promos for the station. I'd be like, hey, I'm Butthole Steve. And this woman was beside herself that she had met the voice of Butthole Steve, but she didn't care that she'd met David, so.
It's okay. She met the character. That's close enough.
She did. She did. So what's new in the tech world? We saw this story about Wendy's, I think in Manhattan, doing surge pricing based on demand, which as a New Yorker, as a transplant New Yorker, I can't be like, hey, I've been here for 104 years. My father was built a house on the Mayflower and was at Ellis Island. I don't know. I've been in New York 3 years. Okay.
That's enough.
But the lines for places that are popular, hotspots, you know, delis, even fast food places, they really bother me. There's a pizza shop not too far from me called Prince Street Pizza, and it's good. But the line wraps around the block, and it's not that good. Sometimes when I walk by the line, I'll scream, it's just pizza, people! And my girlfriend looks at me like I'm crazy. But if they had something like surge pricing, it could, you know, lower demand, which could make it, the wait would be based on demand, and it would be the same product. And if you want it at 7:30 on a Friday night, you know, you're paying a lot. And if you want it at 4 a.m., just before they shutter, because it's a late night pizza spot. I don't think it's open that late. You know, it's a couple bucks, whatever. It's not a terrible idea, but it also reeks of tech company dystopia.
Well, I mean, I think it reflects the fact that we live in a very regimented 9-to-5 world. Whether we like it or not, there's a morning rush hour, there's a lunch rush, there's an afternoon evening rush hour. We tend to work 9-to-5, you know. And there have been some variations over the last number of years. Certainly, the pandemic has changed that somewhat. But if you go out into the real world, things are busy morning, afternoon, and evening, all at around the same times. So that's just the way the world works. And so, you know, you are going to have times, periods of high demand and periods of lower demand. And certainly surge pricing holds the potential to level out some of that demand. So, oh, maybe I won't eat lunch at 12:30. If I can get a deal on my Wendy's burger, maybe I'll shift my schedule around and I'll go in at 2 o'clock. And so then if more enough people do that, then eventually you don't have everyone rushing for the same thing at the same time and those demand curves flatten out. But, you know, we've seen this before, and you know, when surge or dynamic pricing has been used, say in the
I love that. It's like it's not a shitty thing that we're doing as a company. It's a dynamic thing.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just find a really cool way to describe it. But you know, let's be clear. You know, Uber, Lyft, you know, other rideshare gig economy players have been using this technology for years. And I think it's safe to say by now that we've had a number of years of exposure to this. They're not giving us a deal on anything. It's mostly more expensive, sometimes maybe a little bit less expensive, but it's really about maximizing profits and squeezing as much revenue as you can from people when they don't have a whole lot of other choice. Everyone gets out of the baseball game at the same time, and they're all looking for an Uber at the same time. You don't have a choice. You can't wait for a lower demand time. You're going to get hosed if you choose to take that ride home. It's the same thing with Wendy's. If everyone from your company is going out to lunch at around the same time, you're not going to be the person holding your hand up going, I'm going to wait for the prices to go down. You're going to pay whatever it is. And so this was about profit. When they originally announced it, they used the term dynamic pricing. But we know that dynamic pricing and surge pricing are used interchangeably. And based on the Uber experience, it's more expensive. And because of the backlash afterward, of course, Wendy's felt the need to correct it. But you know, the truth of the matter is, this isn't about saving us money. This is about maximizing profit during high demand periods. And you can paint it any other way you want. But that's the way it worked with rideshare. That's the way it's going to work with fast food. That's the way it's going to work with any other industry that dares to apply this revenue model to the way it does business.
I do wonder if it'll maximize profits by scattering demand to off-peak hours. For example, they make the same amount of money during peak hours. They just don't serve as many customers, you know, because they're charging more. Let's say a burger's $10 and 10 people come. Or a burger's $20 and 5 people come. It's they still total $100. But those 5 people that didn't eat because they were waiting for a deal, that demand gets scattered to, you know, 4 p.m. when no one's having food between lunch and dinner. I do wonder if they'll end up making more money like that. But that's actually, I'm not that curious about that. What I do want to tell you is, so I lived in San Francisco for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Cool city.
When I first moved to San Francisco, I'm not sure Uber had launched yet, or if it had, it was not well known. I remember in 2012 and 2011 taking cabs in San Francisco. I'd never experienced anything like it.
So old school.
Scammy, weird routes, no cabs, take forever to come when you call them, rip you off, add like a bridge surcharge for a bridge they didn't go over. Cabs in San Francisco were like nothing I'd ever taken before. I grew up in Toronto, not that cabs there were great. It was such an awful industry. I don't know why, for whatever reason.
Well, it was an entrenched industry that had been around since the beginning of time. It was heavily regulated, but not terrifically enforced. In other words, there were like 8 layers of rules dictating how you became a cabbie. The medallion system, for example, it was almost, it almost got handed down from one generation to the next.
It did. Here's where my socialism's going to come out. I actually think the medallion system, in theory, is good. The reason I think it's good is because I think the public, the city, the government should have the mandate to regulate cars that are picking up strangers, because passenger safety is important. The mandate for the medallion, the reason for the medallion that I think is a good one is, hey, public safety is a concern. These cabs need to have insurance. They need to be trained. They need to not be criminals. They need to not rip people off. This is the general public getting into people's cars. If there was a weird guy in a white van who said, hey, come in my car to one of your daughters, you wouldn't want them going in that guy's car. So the mandate is a good one. Now, the execution in most cities has been terrible. It's created basically a cartel, a terrible product. So I'm sort of like on the side of these libertarian capitalists, you know, disrupting these industries is a good thing. I'm on their side in terms of why they did it, but I'm actually on the government side as to why there should be a system regulating people getting into strangers' cars and paying them in the first place. But for whatever reason, because you give it to the government, especially in the U.S. and San Francisco, which has, in my opinion, having lived there, a really corrupt city hall, the medallion system makes a horrible product. So then you get Uber, and Uber was amazing. In 2012, it was like you take the worst thing in the world and you offer the best and cheapest solution. It was amazing.
Uber was the ultimate example of a revolutionary technology being used to disrupt an industry that was ripe for that disruption. The ideals of having medallions and other forms of regulation in the traditional taxi industry might have made sense at the beginnings of that industry, but over time...
Well, the mandate of public safety, Carmi, the mandate of public safety.
That's right. But over time, it became onerous. And over time, it became inefficient. Over time, it became corrupt. And it essentially opened up that vulnerability for the taxi industry to be disrupted when the technology allowed it to be. And that's really what Uber was. And it was magical at the beginning. And everybody loved the idea of an app-driven, cheap way to get around town, very fluid, no points of friction. Of course, you know, the dark side of that was that that level of accountability, right? The safety, the treating employees so that they can actually have a career. It was exploitative, and as time went on, and the cracks in Uber's armor became more obvious, the rides had to get more expensive. The level of regulation on the gig economy had to become as onerous as it was on taxis.
Well, they were taking advantage of the drivers, Carmi.
Of course they were. Exactly.
And what Uber did and what Lyft did is they just went to municipalities and they just started operating, not giving a fuck about the legal implications.
Yeah. They bullied their way into every market that they entered.
And hired, spent millions, maybe billions, at least hundreds of millions on legals. So they're like, we'll operate in these cities that there's no fucking way that they would allow us. And then we'll just hire the best law firms to try to fight any and all regulation. In my opinion, that's where they went wrong. They should have said, we don't like medallions. We don't like that you need to have a permit to enter this industry, but we do like safety. So like, we'll work with you towards regulating safety, or we'll, you know, give us laws instead of they fought any and all regulation. They didn't give a fuck about consumer safety. They just said, oh, no, we'll take care of safety. We'll come up with the rules. You know, but that means another player can come in and say, hey, we're going to hire drivers that don't pass criminal background checks because then it'll make prices cheaper. What's stopping that evil company from operating if you get rid of all regulation? Nothing. Uber and Lyft just said, hey, we're great companies. We don't allow criminals on. We make sure the drivers have insurance, blah, 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 blah. But there was nothing forcing them to do that. There was nothing forcing them to care about public safety. They just claimed to, and they fought any and all regulation. And to me, that was where they went wrong and where things got ugly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they've paid the price for it. And certainly the early days excesses of those behaviors have certainly been leveled off somewhat in recent years. The companies are perceived as behaving somewhat more responsibly, but on the ground, that means that the rides now by necessity will cost us more. And it means that the algorithms used to determine surge pricing when there is a period of high demand are a lot more aggressive at jacking those prices. And so you're in the middle of a snowstorm and you're trying to get home and it's a period of crisis for the city. And here you have these rideshare companies that are essentially holding the city hostage, holding consumers hostage by charging them whatever the algorithm deems the market will bear at that given moment. And now that we're seeing fast food, for example, starting to pick up the dynamic pricing model, the surge pricing model, it kind of begs the question, are we opening the door? Are we opening a Pandora's box to companies in all sectors using this algorithmically driven model to essentially rip us off because it's expedient for them to do so right now in the moment? And that's kind of where things are scary. There's no longer any pricing transparency. I don't know how expensive that ride will be based on the mathematics behind it. I don't know how expensive that burger is going to be based on the mathematics behind it. I can't plan for purchases anymore because it's software that's determining how much I'm going to pay. And as a consumer, it means it's one other layer of us being taken advantage of.
And it's already happening online. Like Amazon, the price, there's a website called Camel that tracks price changes on Amazon. Amazon just subtly tweaks prices all the time of products that if you were to go into a big box store, I mean, I don't even know how Walmart and Target and all these places function anymore. Maybe they're actually doing what I'm about to say. But what I think they do is they have like a fixed price. You know, it's on the shelf and it's one price one day. You come back a week later, unless something significant happened and across the board they've done a major increase, that commodity is the same price. Whereas on Amazon, if you look on a Sunday at 2, maybe that computer's $700, and if you look at a Monday at 4, it's $710. And it's just this kind of like AI or algorithmically driven pricing is ugly.
It is, because it means consumers no longer have control over the experience from start to finish. And anyone who's ever gone looking for a plane ticket, for example, knows full well how opaque that process is and how impossible it is from the start of the process to the end of the process to really understand exactly how much it's going to cost you, how much you should be laying out, how much of your overall travel budget needs to be allocated to the flight, things like that. So, you know, now it's spreading from one industry to every industry. And I think that's it's a dark cloud for consumers because it shifts control to these multi-billion dollar global companies that have the technology, that have the artificial intelligence, that have the points of input to be able to determine at a granular level exactly what the demand curve is now and what they should be pricing that particular product or service at. And it's frightening. You used to know how much something cost. You used to know how much you needed to save for that. That is no longer the case. And as one industry after another realizes the potential for squeezing even more margin out of consumers who don't have visibility into it, it almost smacks me of like playing a game where you've got one hand tied behind your back. They're putting a blindfold on you and your opponent sees and knows everything. And you're expected to go into the same ring and play with them. That's just not fair.
It isn't. Let me go off on fucking Uber for a little more because I'm just like,
let's do.
Let's talk about the fixed pricing. So they set the price with the surge pricing. They set the price on this marketplace. Well, they claim it's a marketplace. They claim it's a marketplace where they connect independent contractors, the drivers.
Oh, please.
to customers. But they're fixing the price.
Yeah.
You know, if these are independent contractors, they should be able to set their own price.
Exactly.
But I mean, some cities, some states, some provinces, some countries don't allow this. They basically said, screw you, Uber. You actually have to treat these like employees. But like, isn't the point of independent contractors? It's like you set your rate, you set what you do, you set how you do it. If a company's fixing your price and saying when and when not can you work, like This is not a marketplace. These are employees, in my opinion.
There's nothing independent about them. It isn't a marketplace. The so-called independent contractors have no control over their destiny. They can't determine price. They can't determine terms of how they deliver those services. They're subject to some very strict and rigid rules from these platform companies that determine exactly sort of what, you know, how they should act and how they should not act and have punishments, including delisting from that platform if they fail to comply. But then, of course, they don't get the benefit of, they're basically employees without the benefits because they don't have any of the advantages that an employee would have. So it's the worst of all possible worlds. And they've rolled into markets and essentially imposed themselves on markets, destroying the incumbent players in the process and leaving people who just want to drive a vehicle and get people where they're going, however, you know, whatever model it takes, then they just want to make money at it. They want to build a life. They want to have a career. They want to keep their lights on just like everyone else. But now there's less choice for them to do so. And it's the most cynical kind of disruption that I've ever seen in tech. And quite frankly, the fact that it's even allowed to happen at this point means the consumers are worse off. And those who provide those local business people who used to build businesses, used to have a taxi business that was a local owned organization that funded little league teams.
Yeah, like a 10 car company that's just like an airport taxi. Put them all out of business.
Exactly. That no longer exists. And that money that you pay for that ride to get from wherever you're going now no longer stays within your local economy. It leaves the local economy because more of that money doesn't stay in the driver's pocket. It goes to the platform. And so this is where we're at. Technology has disrupted us. It hasn't really given us cheaper rides. It hasn't really given us safer rides. It certainly hasn't enhanced the career prospects of the people behind the wheel. And it doesn't show any signs of getting better because the regulation that would rein in these worst excesses of behavior doesn't seem to be on the horizon. And quite frankly, most levels of government don't seem to have an interest in pursuing it.
And they spend so much money trying to fight that regulation. If they spent half that money taking care of their drivers, I actually don't know how much money that is. So I'm pulling this number out of my ass. But the point I hope is well taken. If they spent half the money that they spent fighting regulation concerning consumer safety and treating their drivers like shit, then the drivers would have a better life. I was crescendoing towards a point here, which is now that I live in New York, I've taken Ubers, and the encouragement of Uber to get drivers on the platform who will accept less and less money, come from further and further away from Manhattan, and know less and less about the city means Ubers suck in New York. They don't know what they're doing in Manhattan. They'll just take the bizarre streets. They'll sit in traffic without knowing better. Cabbies in New York were always good. They're jerks. They'll dick you around, but they're New Yorkers. You can yell at them and they'll yell right back at you, and it's not even a fight. I love taxis in Manhattan. They are cheaper. The price is set. You know, there's no surge pricing in a taxi.
Yeah, it's predictable.
It's predictable. And cabbies, at least in Manhattan, know what they're doing. They know how to get through the grind. They know who to get through the grid. They know which routes to take. And if you think they're taking a bad route, you can just start an argument with them and they'll know what they're talking about and they'll do what you want. I love taxis in New York. But when I first moved here, I just thought Uber, Uber, Uber. And because I just didn't know better. I was living in San Francisco for so long. And I just would be waiting for them to come. They wouldn't, you know, how to turn down my one-way street. So they do a big thing around the block. And I'm like, I can just walk out to the closest major street, stick out my hand, and get to the airport twice as fast for the same price or less if it's surge time. Cabbies are great, at least in New York. I don't know if this is true for Toronto anymore.
I grew up in Montreal, and it was like that in Montreal when I was a kid, because these were cabbies who had been doing it for their entire lives. And so they knew the map, they committed it to memory. In fact, if you go to, you know, in London, England, they call it, I think it's called the knowledge, and cab drivers there had to take a comprehensive series of exams where they basically had to memorize the map of the greater London area, and they would be challenged with routes. They have to manually figure out the route. What's the most efficient route between two points? And no GPS, no technology. It's all in their minds. And so you think, here's someone who really knows intimately the ins and outs of the local geography, has taken years to study it to get to that point of familiarity. And you've now replaced it with someone who essentially there are no background checks. They just load an app up on their phone. They meet the minimum qualifications and off you go. So like everything, technology seems to have this ability to water down what was once, you know, a locally delivered, richly cultured kind of service that is no longer locally rooted at all. And it kind of makes you wonder, where do all of these local experts go? Because they certainly aren't driving for Uber.
No. How do we go from Wendy's surge pricing to Uber? I don't know. I mean, I guess it was through surge pricing.
Well, but exactly. And surge pricing is essentially like, and I think that's why I'm glad to see Wendy's get slapped on the face on this, that they tried to use the term, they got caught, and now they're backtracking. Oh, we didn't use the word surge pricing. We used dynamic. So it's about saving money for our customers. It's not about charging more for burgers. We would never do that. No, you didn't say that up front. You're only backtracking because there was an outcry. And so I think this is a flashpoint moment for any industry that's been looking at surge pricing or dynamic pricing and thinking, could this apply to us? Could this allow us to level demand? Could it allow us to squeeze more margin out of particular times of the daily business cycle? And from an efficiency perspective, maybe it can, but from a customer relations perspective, a cultural perspective, you want to be very careful about considering whether that should be applied to your business, because it's yet another sort of, you know, where the slope starts to loosen. And, you know, we start to go down that slippery slope where companies yet again use efficiency as an excuse to kill the customer experience and abuse customers that have gotten to where they are at this point. And so technology for technology's sake, Wendy's, I'm really sorry. Those are lovely boards, you know, those electronic menus. Tim Hortons has had them for years. They have used it to change what they offer through the day, depending on time of day or weather or other conditions, but they haven't used it to change prices. And you might want to reconsider even using those terms, because technology that abuses your customer is a technology you shouldn't be using at all.
Well, if you're insane enough to be happy to go to Times Square, to be happy to go to Times Square and go to Wendy's in Times Square, because this article mentions the Wendy's in Times Square charging more, and then you're unhappy about the price.
Yeah.
You deserve what's coming to you. Who's insane enough to go to Wendy's in Times Square? That's literally the most insane thing I've... If a friend of mine was like, hey, I'm just at Wendy's in Times Square on the phone, I would just be like, you are literally the most crazy person I've ever talked to in my life.
Yeah. go for a walk, find something a few blocks away, which is what I've done every single time I'm in Times Square. I won't eat there for exactly that reason. It doesn't matter what the restaurant is.
Disagree. If you find yourself voluntarily in Wendy's in Times Square, go check yourself into a psych ward. You are not a well person.
Fair enough.
I've seen that Wendy's. I've never walked into that Wendy's. That would be my personal hell to walk in there.
Well, I will see you from afar if that's the case. I might take a picture of it from across the street, but I won't go in.
I don't go to town. I mean, I do like Broadway shows, so that's the only time I find myself in and around Times Square. But no, I'm
trying to eat less fast food too. You know, I mean, I think that's just a health thing. It's not good for us. Ugh.
I just spent all of February avoiding sweets, and I lost 5 pounds.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah,
good on you. I want to know your secret.
All like December and January, it was like cakes and cookies and chocolates. I baked 2 cakes in that month. I was once in Walgreens or what, like Shoppers Drug Mart, whatever, you know, a drugstore. And there was these snacks called Oreo Cakesters. Okay.
Oh, I've seen it. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. They're like Twinkie Oreos. Okay. It's like if you're from Canada, it's like a Joe Louis almost, which is like, yeah. It's like a chocolate pastry puff of Twinkie quality.
Yeah. Or Little Debbie.
Yeah, with vanilla icing in the middle. It's sort of Oreo-esque. There was a box of 10. And I'm like, these look good. And then underneath the box, there was a price thing that said 2-for-1 special. Like, you know, $5, whatever. For two, I'm like, 2 boxes? This is a great deal.
Sold.
So I buy them. This was maybe late December. I bring them home. I say to my girlfriend, look, I got these treats. She looks at the box. She's like, I'm not fucking eating that. Somehow, 20 Oreo Cakesters disappear in like a 6-day period. This was what I was doing on a daily basis. So all of February, I still ate junk. I didn't eat fast food, but like I had fried chicken one night. Mm-hmm. You know, I ate lots of pasta. I wasn't dieting. I just cut out the sweets.
Yeah, you just picked sugar and cut it out. Yeah, start somewhere. Keep it simple. That makes a lot of sense.
5 pounds in 30 days. I guess 29.
That's very impressive.
Yeah.
I think I'm going through my pantry when we're done here. Let's see what I can cut out.
Well, tomorrow I'm going sweet crazy. I might have a cake. But then I'm thinking, how can I keep this momentum going? And now I'm thinking one sweet a week. And then Miranda, my girlfriend, she's like, well, what about with me? What if I want a dessert? And then you go and have your sweet alone. I'm like, here's a great plan. One sweet with you and one sweet myself. And they're not interchangeable. If I use my personal sweet allotment, I can still have a sweet with you. If I have a sweet with you, I can't have another, even if my personal allotment's free. That way there's no like, oh, you didn't have sweets with me kind of thing.
Sounds like an opportunity for an app, maybe, you know, to track your sweet consumption, both individually and collectively.
Oh, what a dystopian fucking hell you're suggesting on me.
Bonus points if it works on the Apple Watch, and then you can track it right on your wrist.
I'm wearing a Casio for, what, $7? I had one die a year ago. I just threw it out and bought a new one.
I love Casio. You know, my favorite watch is my Casio. I've had it forever. I've beat it to hell. It's the one I wear when I'm on my bike because I don't care about it. If I fall, it will always come back for more. They make the best watches on planet Earth. And I would happily wear one under a suit if I had the opportunity.
I'm showing my watch up to you in this little video I have here. My watch, it's the black Casio. It's the classic. It's the F91W.
Oh, those are. And in fact, there's huge. It was introduced like, what, 40 years ago?
Don't step on my punch. I'm about to say who famously wore this watch. Do you know?
Was that Bill Clinton or Bill Gates?
Close. You're very close. You're very close.
Oh, goodness. I don't know who. Jimmy Carter?
Osama bin Laden. It was the bin Laden watch. It's like the one photo of bin Laden with his buddies and the AK-47s, and he's wearing the watch. And there was an article, I don't know what. I usually just say the New Yorker to make myself sound smart, but I have no idea where this article was printed. But there's an article about how this watch is so ubiquitous. Like bin Laden's wearing it. Like I think some like Scandinavian politician who wanted to be like a workers' party. Like everyone is wearing this watch and has for 40 years. It's about $7 to $10 depending on where you buy it. And it's reliable and it's like the classic digital watch. Look, if it was good enough for bin Laden, it was good enough for me. Say what you want about Bin Laden, but he was always very punctual.
Yeah, he knew his watches. Yeah, exactly. They are very accurate. I'll give you that. They're wonderful watches. Yeah, and built like nobody's business. You can get them wet. You can roll over them with a car.
Look, you're supposed to be at the airport at 3:30 p.m. to hijack a plane. What if your watch dies and you miss the flight? You know what I'm saying? Right. I don't support anything to do with terrorism, but say what you want about them, they were always very punctual.
That's right. Hey, there's positive to everything, I guess.
So you're saying you like Bin Laden. All right, we have that officially. Carmi Levy, fan of Bin Laden.
Well, I'm sure Cassio really appreciates the PR value of having the world's most wanted terrorist and notorious terrorist wearing their brand. Yes.
Yeah. It launched in 1989. And yeah, it's use in the Wikipedia page is a big thing about use in terrorism. A lot of prisoners who got detained and sent to Guantanamo Bay were wearing them.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, when you're spending all of your money on ammunition and guns and bombs and stuff, and you probably don't have a whole lot of extra money to spend on watches. So that's probably the standard issue to your typical global terrorist. That's what I'm guessing.
There's a Vice article, Why Terrorists Love Casio's Iconic F91W Watch.
Well, that's an interesting association you have on your wrist now there, David.
I mean, it's not that it's a terrorist watch. It's just everyone has it,
Yeah. And think back to when we were kids, right? The first watch that I bought for myself was a Casio. I forget the particular model, but it was, saved up my money. I think it was $15 at the time, whatever it was. And it's not that much more now because they're so easy to mass produce. This is a company that's figured out, the universality of watches. And in many cases, if you're a watch, and I'm a bit of a watch hog, I follow the industry. I've got a collection. I have a number of watch boxes because I just like looking at them. And for a lot of kids, that's where the joy starts, right? That's where you start with something that's cheap that you can afford that does some really cool things. And admittedly, Casios have always had a million neat features on them, and you build from there. But then when you get older and you can afford better, you still like having Casios in your collection. And if you look at some of the models they have today, you can spend easily well into the four figures on a Casio if you want to, or you can spend $15. Take your pick.
Do you know what I'm showing you right now? I'm holding a little circuit board up.
Is that a Raspberry Pi?
It is a Raspberry Pi.
There you go.
And Casios were not my gateway into playing with computers. Being alone a lot as a kid in a household with three siblings and a computer in my sister's room that she never used was like my gateway into computer programming, which is what I did before I got into radio and podcasting and stuff. But I still, for fun, as a hobby. I used to be a software engineer and then a software engineering manager, and radio and performing and comedy and all these kinds of things were my hobby. And my job was computers. Now media is my job and computers are my hobby. Tell us quickly what you're talking about tinkering and watches being the gateway drug into tinkering. What is a Raspberry Pi as you know it?
Raspberry Pi is basically it's the guts of a computer, and you buy it for, I think it's the first one was $35.
You can still get them for that, but the good ones now are about like 60.
Yeah, the good ones are a little bit more expensive, and it's been through a number of iterations and generations, but basically it's an incredibly cheap computer. All it is essentially is a circuit board with all of the parts on it that make it a fully functioning computer. And then from that point, you can either build a machine, you can build it to do any kind of customized function you want. There's an entire community out there that shares Raspberry Pi based project ideas. You can watch YouTube videos. You can build pretty much anything off of this thing, and some incredibly sophisticated, like for example, the military. A lot of military units actually use this to create computers and create devices that help them do a better job. Or companies will do the same thing. It's a hacker's paradise, and I use the word hacker in the best possible way. This is not dark hat hacking. This is white hat hacking, finding cool ways to leverage technology on the cheap. And Raspberry Pi is really the center of this amazing culture.
Yeah, like the classic project that I saw on YouTube, which I've always wanted to do. Okay, it's a little embedded computer, and it's got, USB ports, got internet ports on it. It's got an HDMI for a monitor, whatever. But it's also got these pins on it called GPIO, and I don't want to get too technical here, but it's just basically general purpose input output. What is general purpose input output? Well, you can hook up sensors to it, like a motion detector or an infrared sensor or a light sensor or a little motor, or any kinds of physical devices that might exist in a robot, in a car, you can connect to this machine. So a classic project that I saw on YouTube was somebody set up a, I don't know what, it was either a motion sensor or a door opening sensor, who knows, and then they wired a speaker up to it. And they put it by their front door, and every time their front door opened, the Raspberry Pi sensed it, and then it played one of the bass riffs from Seinfeld. And I've always wanted to do that. They're also popular in digital signage. They're popular on, you know, a little server. You can have your media on here. You could play videos off it. And so, yeah, I just play with them, whatever. I do little hacky projects, but and I'm particularly interested in, like, telephones, connecting two telephones together without a real telephone circuit. Yeah, so I play with them, and I don't know how you got off on the F91 being a gateway into more technology, but for me it was sitting on my sister's computer using QBasic, which was a programming language for kids, or just people who didn't know how to program. And you know, years down the line, it was my career. I did study it, and I still hack with these things. So
I think that's what I love about technologies like this, is that they're cheap and incredibly accessible. And in the age of the internet, it's easy for some, you know, creative kid to acquire the technology and then connect with a community online and, you know, use it to essentially self-teach. And so I would expect that going forward, you'll have entire generations of developers, technologists, people who work in the industry and beyond, who this was their gateway drug. This was their first exposure to that technology. And I was just that kind of kid as well. I'd spend my, you know, evenings and weekends and, you know, sort of my free time, youngest of three kids, you know, essentially teaching myself how all this technology worked. And boy, I look at Raspberry Pi and I think, how cool it would have been not only to have technology like that as a child, but also access to the internet, because I was just young enough that it was just not a thing just yet. We were online, but not to the same degree. The internet existed, by the way, when I was a kid, just not like it does today. And so you put the two together, and you have this, you know, almost like an avenue for kids who may not necessarily sort of fit into any other mold to, you know, create almost a future for themselves. And I think that's wonderful. Technology has always been an opportunistic career path for me and for so many others. And it's technology like this that in so many cases enables it.
Yeah, I remember the early internet. You'd go on there and you'd load up, you know, the pornography.
Are you sure that's just the early internet, David?
Well, no, I mean, if you look at companies like Pornhub and stuff, some of the great technology that drives YouTube, that drives Twitch, that drives any kind of stream or mass video delivery system, the porn industry figured out that technological problem first. Like video encodings, it's funny. How's a video file work? Well, there's a group of, you know, there's a consortium of people, usually representatives from companies, that figure out what the next standard for how videos will be represented on your computer, whatever. But on these consortiums for, like, you know, there's someone from Google, there's someone from Microsoft, there's always someone from, like, a pornography company. If you look at consortiums for, like, how HTML might work, how websites might work, obviously there's no porn representatives, but only with video encoding, these people, like, drive. But I just remember as a kid, the image would be slowly loading from the top down, and you'd get to the face, and you'd be like, do I want to wait another 30 seconds? And then it'd get to the midriff, and you'd be like, is this photo worth waiting the 3 minutes, or is it a loser?
Try another one. Those are the days. But this was an industry that truly benefited from early adoption of next generation technologies. And you hate to admit it. I hate to admit that Pornhub is based in Montreal, my hometown. And that on my commute to work on my bike, I used to pass by their offices every morning, unbeknownst to me. But at the same time, this is, you know, technology will disrupt industries, whether we like it or not. And those industries also, whether we like it or not, do include the adult film industry. And, you know, we owe a lot, like a lot of the standards that we take for granted now for high resolution video, for high bandwidth communications, for storage, a lot of them were pushed forward faster because of the adult content industry's involvement and engagement. They pushed the boundaries. I almost feel a little dirty thinking about it, because it's sort of weird, but, you know, in a somewhat perverse way, we use better technology today because of it. And it sort of got to our desktops faster than would have otherwise been the case.
I mean, what are we doing right now? Talking over video chat. Like, the technology driving what we're doing right now was pushed by, pardon the pun, or maybe that wasn't a pun, I don't even know, push.
that was intentional.
It was pushed by the adult industry. Would we be where we were at, you know, video encoding wise without them? Maybe not. Maybe we'd be a few years behind. Who knows? But it's funny how technology, it doesn't care where it comes from, you know, it doesn't care what.
So basically what you're saying is thank a porn actor today. Okay, I get it.
Yeah, why not? These people work hard.
That's right. I don't really know porn actors, but, you know, somewhere out there, wherever you are, thank you.
That makes one of us. I know a couple, actually. I've had one on this show recently, actually. Not too recently, but somewhat recently. Her name was Basia.
Cool.
All right, Carmi, let's leave it at that. We definitely got through one story. The Wendy story, which I think, you know, one story in 40 minutes. Hey, we're doing great. It's a fucking podcast. What are you going to do?
I'll do better next time, I promise.
It's always great to have you.
Good to be here. I really appreciate the invitation. Thanks, David.